let me in. Shibba. I want to be closer to you.
Shibba, shibba.
Open up your soul.
Shibba, shibba.
Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. The following interview was done back in July. It's one of my science envoys, and we're going to listen to that. And then a little later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Rani Ben-David, who's the Director of Social Justice and Inclusion. So just hang in there and enjoy this rebroadcast. Here is my science envoy du jour. Welcome, Enrico Calvanese. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. So before we get into your science, let's get into you, which is, when did you first discover that you were really into science?
Right, so I was thinking about that question, and it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly when I started getting curious about how things happen and how to explain the world around us. But I'm a plant biologist. I'm studying plant biology at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you when I got interested in plant biology or just the understanding of plants. I remember this very clearly. I was watching a documentary as a child. This must have been when I was either in middle school or elementary school. I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. But I really loved watching documentaries. Mm-hmm. And generally, they were all about animals, you know, National Geographic or Discovery Channel. But this one was talking about plants. And I had never really thought about plants much until that point. But they were discussing how giant bamboos, which are originally to some parts of Asia, mm-hmm. can grow up to 1 meter in one day if the right conditions are present. And that fascinated me way more than anything that I had watched before.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I realized I think I need to understand how something like that can happen, how organisms that seems to be so, well, maybe not simple, but maybe passive, maybe they're in the background. You don't really think about plants all that much, but they mm-hmm. can do such amazing things. That was the moment where I really decided, okay, I'm going to pay attention to the organisms and I'm going to try to understand them better.
That's very cool. If I had watched that documentary, I would be begging my parents to get me a baby bamboo to see if I could watch it grow over the, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So
yeah, it's impressive.
Yeah, it really is. So you hear this and it hits your imagination the way nothing can. So going forward, are you reading more about plants or does that something that happens later on?
Yeah, so from that moment on, I, of course, nothing happened immediately mm-hmm. after watching the documentary, but I started being, of all the classes that I was taking, elementary school student, and then later high schooler, I started to really get more interested in biology. Mm-hmm. And I had the fortune to be selected for a science, like young researcher program, where I was given the option in, well, the country where I was raised, which is the country of Panama, mm-hmm. to participate in research, just to shadow someone that was doing research and then present my findings at a young scientist's fair. Something that's, you know, not incredibly impactful, but for me, it was really impactful. And the reason I was able to get selected was because I proposed to study how bamboos can grow so fast and in such a short period of time. So that documentary led me to get interested in science, talk about science, even in a, well, at the time it was definitely a more childish and superficial way, but at least show enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And then that channeled me through fortune and the good stewardship of my mother into the right programs that eventually actually got me to participate in real science.
So when you got that that grant to talk about it, about how old were you?
So by that time, it was, I'm trying to remember the year more or less. Well, I was in what would be the equivalent of a freshman year of high school.
Oh, okay. So you're still pretty young.
Yes, because that was a program that functioned in that way. It was intended to get young people, and that's, you know, really young people, so high schoolers, elementary kids, middle schoolers, to be interested in science and to, in one way, participate with real scientists and at a young adult's fair present their science.
So when you were shadowing this scientist, was that scientist also someone who studied plants, or what kind of science did they do, and what kind of questions did you have for them, and was it exciting to trail this person around and ask questions?
No, I think that's a good question, because although I proposed a scientific question, a scientific project that related to studying bamboos, and at the time I was proposing something really grandiose. If we understand how bamboos grow so fast, maybe we can make other plants grow so fast. Mm-hmm. Maybe trees that give us fruits can go so fast. And I was proposing something that was very ambitious, and of course it's what a high schooler would do. But that only showed my enthusiasm to a sort of screening team that eventually picked me to shadow someone that was doing graduate level research in something completely different.
Uh-huh.
I ended up studying through that program how malaria parasites, which are actually endemic to the Republic of Panama and cause a lot of devastation, unfortunately, how malaria parasites infect the blood, communicate with each other, considering there are multiple of them in the bloodstream, how they communicate with each other, how they send signals, and how those signals eventually can lead to really negative outcomes in patients. So it's an interesting story because my interest in one area of biology, plant biology, at that moment allowed me to participate in a program that then channeled me to a different area of biology. And then from there, I did research. I did the kind of research that, yes, it had to do with malaria parasites, very different from plant biology.
Sure.
But was still related to biology. Still taught me the basic principles of how a lab that studies living things operates and how to pose questions. And it's the posing the questions that is the most important lesson from these kind of experiences. It's not so much the direct experiments and the results that you get from them. At such an early level, that what's really important is how to ask questions and how to think about answering those questions.
So when you were shadowing this person, were they the ones that helped you understand how to ask the questions? And if so, how did they do that?
Well, yeah. So at the time, they... Because I was only a high schooler shadowing graduate students, and those graduate students had projects on which their entire graduation and career depended. And of course, it didn't give me the kind of freedom to just run around and do experiments in the lab. They had me shadow all of their daily activities.
Uh-huh.
They didn't really let me touch the expensive equipment, but I was there to see how they did it. And then they let me do everything else that was both low risk in terms of, you know, personal safety risk, as well as not so complex that I wouldn't be able to perform it.
Okay.
But they taught me, well, if this is up to where the field in this particular area is, the area of malaria research, here's up where we are. Here are the things that really matter for our field to understand if we want to eventually come up with a cure for malaria. Mm-hmm. Before we get to that point, we need to understand how this parasite infects the blood cells, how it does critical steps in its biology.
Mm-hmm.
And here is how we think we can answer a very specific question in a very specific time frame, which is the time frame of that graduate student's graduate career.
Wow, that's incredible. So they light a fire under you in a different section of biology. So then right. you go on to university, and do you pursue biology generally? Do you pursue a specific sub genre of biology? What happens once you hit university?
Right. So that was sort of a stepping stone for me to eventually be convinced that this is really what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Early high schooler, I realized, okay, I want to become a scientist. But I want to still go back to my original interest in plant biology.
Okay.
And once I had determined that that should be the path forward, then I started to reflect on how I could get there. And there is no real other way than to do an undergraduate degree in a biology-related field, mm-hmm. and then do a PhD, which is where I am right now, in that area. So I started from that sort of premise that I need to do these steps to become a researcher. And then I went and looked at where those could be completed, where I could do those degrees, and I looked at the United States because it was the most accessible education system nearby the Republic of Panama that mm-hmm. I could get into.
Okay.
So I looked at a number of universities. I was fortunate enough, again, through the good stewardship of my mother, to end up in an early entrance to college program, which is virtually a program that allows seniors and juniors in high school to go to an American university to finish their high school there and get dual credit.
Wow.
So I did that, and that was in Missouri, at Northwest Missouri State University.
Uh-huh.
When I graduated from high school, I had an Associate of Science degree because I had taken those high school credits, college credits.
Uh-huh.
And then I was able to use that. I already had sort of my foot in the door of the American education system, so I understood a lot better how to apply to finally undergraduate university, and so I did so, and I was able to get into Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania, where I did majored in biochemistry and molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I realized the most important thing that I needed to do while I was an undergraduate was to build up my resume in terms of research experience, as well as having decent grades. The most important thing was really get into the lab of someone at that undergraduate university to demonstrate later on what I would apply to a PhD program, that I had the skills, the experience, and most importantly, the interest and persistence to pursue research. And so from the first year of my undergraduate career at that university, I contacted the only professor in that university, quite a small college, I was the only professor that did plant biology research,
and
asked him to join my lab, if I could join his lab. And he was very generous, allowed me to join from the start. And then I stayed there for 3 years doing research. And actually, he was a plant biologist. Yeah, so I was able to do research in plant biology. And that gave me the skill set and the curriculum to be able to apply to UC Berkeley's plant biology program. In 2020, I started my PhD, and now I'm at the end of my fourth year, so beginning my fifth year.
Okay. It sounds like you were very, very focused and disciplined about getting from point A to point B in terms of your academic career, and it sounds like your mom was thoroughly on board with it.
Yes, she never. Well, I want to be clear that she never forced me into any particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to make sure that I really was dedicated to, and that I really had a genuine interest in science. And once she saw that, she was all hands on deck to help me get to where I got. So eventually, where I got. there's also a bit of a technical aspect to being so, I guess, focused on getting, as you said, from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
As for international students, it's a little harder to take things like gap years and to maybe be more flexible in one's career path than it is for domestic students.
Sure.
It has to do with complicated things such as visas and, well, I don't want to get into that. But there was both the, yeah, the tenacity on the and the support from my mother, as well as the way things work if you're an international student in the United States.
Yeah, I have relatives from Panama, and I've seen firsthand what, you know, the whole visa thing. So I feel your pain. So, but I'm very impressed by your, you know, your focus and your drive. And I'm sure that that carried through whenever anybody interviewed you for things. I do have a question. Is there a difference between being a plant biologist and being a botanist?
Yeah. So sometimes the terms are used interchangeably. And for the most, there's no harm done in using them interchangeably.
Uh-huh.
And the field, the ways you could study plants are so wide that at the end the lines really get blurred. Well, I tell people I'm a plant cell biologist because what I really study is the individual workings of a cell in a very specific kind of plant.
Oh, okay.
Botanists, and perhaps botanists may even have a different definition of how they see themselves, botanists are perhaps more focused on development, on taxonomy, on maybe ecosystem level understanding of studies of plant biology. You would imagine, for example, somebody that works for the National Forest Service or National Park Service and that is in charge of classifying, cataloging the species in the park that they work at or in the United States, and studying their health, the overall health of those forests or of those trees. It's a more, I suppose, it's a different scale of study. Whereas a plant biologist can, of course, study that when necessary, but a plant biologist may be studying different things at a different scale, much closer to the molecular level. At the end, anything that we study just generally tends to go back to the molecular level, the cell biology level.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you study a particular plant. Is it bamboo?
Yeah. So I study, so before I tell you the name of the plant that I study, it's useful to give some context.
Okay.
So you know how when researchers that want to cure human diseases like cancer, dementia, all sorts of diseases, they go and they study not a human necessarily, but lab rats, lab mice, or other organisms, other animals like worms, like fruit flies. That's because obviously you cannot experiment in humans, but it's also technically more challenging to experiment in a human being, if besides the ethical considerations. So those are called model organisms. A mouse is a model organism. It serves as a mammal that is close enough to humans that you can understand human biology through the lenses of mice biology.
Okay.
It's not, of course, a perfect comparison, and later more studies are performed, like in primates, to get closer and eventually clinical trials. So there's that whole progression. If you are studying human diseases and you want to propose a cure to a disease, you have to start with a model organism and then move up the ladder, and at each scale show that your treatment is effective or that your principle is valid.
Okay.
And in plant biology, there's a similar pattern. So what we would like to do is understand how crops work, because that is what has the largest impact to human society.
Mm-hmm.
How do we grow better wheat? How do we grow better corn? How do we grow better fruit trees?
Mm-hmm.
But those organisms take a long time to grow, And some of them can be very big indeed, like fruit trees. If you wanted to understand how apples work, you cannot study them in a small lab because it's an apple tree. It's huge. So you need to go back to a model organism, a species that is small, easy to handle, but it's still a plant. It can give you very good insights into how plants work.
Okay.
And after that long answer, I get to the plant that I study, which is called Arabidopsis thaliana, also called mouse ear crest. And it's a family that includes the mustards, but this plant specifically doesn't have, you wouldn't have found it on your backyard or anywhere. It's native to Europe. It's a very small plant, and it's very versatile for the study of plant biology because it has a small genome. So everything, its entire DNA has been sequenced. It can produce a lot of seeds, which is good if you want to study, if you want to have a lot of plant material, and if you want to do all sorts of studies that require you to have a lot of progeny. You can easily manipulate it genetically to ask questions about how specific parts of the genome work. And therefore, it's a very versatile and very good model organism.
Wow. So you have, so what's it called again, the street name for it?
Let's just call it Arabidopsis.
Arabidopsis. So you have this Arabidopsis. You're looking at it under the microscope. And what is it that you are seeing when you are, and what is it that you're looking for when you're looking at it in the microscope?
Yes, and now we get under really into the weeds of the work, so I'm going to try to be as understanding that this is, I'm going to try to avoid jargon, but so what I am particularly asking, and, you know, this plant is studied by hundreds of thousands of people, and each of those researchers is asking a different question. I am one of them. I'm asking specifically how a protein of interest, okay, actually, let's start from first principle. We have observed that one of the many genes in the Arabidopsis genome, when it's knocked out, which means when it is affected in a way that prevents it from being functional, so we get rid of this gene by all means and by all intents and purposes. We get rid of this gene. We observe that a plant that would normally grow very well, be very healthy, grows into a very poor, very dwarfed, sterile plant. So it has a lot of problems developing.
Okay.
So we see there's a big developmental effect of knocking out this gene. This gene must be really important for something in this plant at the cellular level that allows the plant to grow normally. Because when we lack it, when we lack this gene, the plant doesn't grow well.
Okay.
And so then we started studying what this gene does, and we realized, we noticed, okay, this is a protein. It's this gene has the information to encode for a protein that's normal, so that is the general way that biology works. You have a gene that eventually gets turned into a protein, and the protein is the actual part that performs a function. The gene is just the information. And this protein is moving other proteins around. So it's kind of like a little messenger inside the cell, taking things from one point to another. And what I looked under the microscope, to get to your question, is how was the cell of a plant that doesn't have, of an Arabidopsis plant that doesn't have this gene, how is this cell moving things around, the things that would require that gene? And what we noticed is that, well, it really cannot do that function at all. You'd really need to have this gene in order to move critical material around the cell. And without it, those materials don't move. And what we're trying to show is that this is really important for the development of the plant to justify our initial observation that this gene is important for development.
So when you're looking underneath, and like, are you seeing actual physical movement, or are you seeing chemical reactions? What is it that is going on in that cell that you can see?
Right. So yes, we're looking at the physical movement of these cargo proteins. So we call them cargo proteins. They are the ones that our gene is responsible for moving. So they are the things that normally would be moving, but in our plant, they're not moving the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we observe them is actually probably going to be very interesting, I think, for people to hear. It is we use a fluorescent tag to see their movement under the microscope. What does that mean? This is not just something that is just done in plants. Actually, 20 or 25 or so years ago, it was discovered that it's possible to take a gene from a jellyfish. So bear with me. Take a gene from a jellyfish, which, as you may know, are autoluminescent in water. When you move the water, you're kayaking, you may see autoluminescence. There is a green autoluminescence. So there, you can take a gene that makes this green fluorescence, and you can engineer it so that it's fused to the proteins that you want to observe. Normally, you wouldn't be able to observe proteins because they don't have any color.
Okay.
But if you put this sort of flag by engineering this jellyfish gene as a flag on the protein that you want to see, and then you put that into, you transform that into the genome of your plant, then you will be able to observe whichever protein it is that you're interested in observing. Then you can see it under the microscope. If you shine lasers at it, it will luminesce in a bright green color, and you'll be able to actually observe inside a cell that protein moving. It's a way of turning the invisible into the visible by putting a flag on it.
Wow. And is that, is taking that bioluminescent material from jellyfish something that is used widely?
Yes. This is a widely used technique for decades now to understand how things, well, proteins, move around cells. So one of the first questions that somebody will be interested in asking as a researcher is, if I am studying protein A or protein B, where does it go in the cell? Because that's deeply going to be related to the function of that protein. And so the best way to address that, the cheapest, most practical way to address that, is by fusing this green fluorescent protein, GFP, onto your protein of interest. So once you have that fusion of your protein A with GFP, then you can look at the localization of protein A. And it's widely effective, widely used across organisms. And you may have seen at some point, maybe if these are the things that interest you, images of fluorescent mice and fluorescent fruit flies, because they have this genetic modification. And it's because, well, somebody was interested in studying where a mouse protein or a fruit fly protein was localizing.
And does does adding this affect it in any other way besides its luminescence, or is it something that is pretty neutral?
So this is something that scientists evaluate on an individual case by case, So yeah, that is a very valid question. If you're adding this tag, this fluorescent tag, is it affecting the way the protein, the original protein, works? And the answer can be yes or no. And so to know if you're really observing the true localization and true function of your protein, you have to do what is called a complementation experiment, where you take, so let's imagine that you're studying mutant protein A. You want to know protein's A localization.
Mm-hmm.
You take a mouse that has been edited, so it doesn't have protein A. So this mouse is lacking protein A. And you transform this mouse, or there's a Arabidopsis plant, I'm just using a general model organism, and you transform that mouse with the protein A plus GFP. So you want to see that mutant mouse, the mouse that doesn't have the protein, once it's introduced, once it's given the protein fused with GFP, whether it can look like a normal mouse. And if it can, that means that your protein plus the green fluorescence jellyfish GFP actually has a normal function because it can rescue the function of a mutant. I hope the concept makes sense.
It kind of does, yeah. So you're if I'm understanding it, you're saying that you compare the two, and if they behave the same, then you know everything's okay.
Exactly. If it works just the way that the regular protein without the GFP works, then you know that it's a functional protein, and that the GFP tagging, that adding the fluorescence protein, doesn't affect the protein in any meaningful way.
And then what do you do with the knowledge that is gained from observing these cells, these microscopic cells?
Right. So that generally the information that you get from these microscopic, this is called microscopic evidence, it gives you insights into where the protein is functional, mm-hmm. as well as if there are any difference between a mutant or a what would be called a wild type, so a normal organism. In my case, I observe that my proteins of interest are not localized correctly in the mutant background, the mutant that I am studying. And so this is a very direct evidence that the protein that I study, the mutant that I study, is needed mm-hmm. for localizing those proteins in the right position. Once I have that evidence, I will go on to do a lot of other studies that are targeted directly at those proteins that I have demonstrated have a defect. And so I don't want to perhaps make it too complicated, but this will depend on a case by case. So in my case, I can see, okay, my gene of interest mm-hmm. affects the localization of this set of proteins. This set of proteins has a function. This function could be a function in working at this part of the cell, or making this part of the cell, or building the plant in this way, making a leaf, making a root, making a part of or a chemical compound. Okay, so I've discovered it has this function. Now I need to test whether each of these genes is affecting this process directly. I have this hint that there is a function that's being affected, and I need to then design specific experiments for that specific function that I have detected.
Wow. And so after you've designed all this, what is your ultimate goal?
So at this level, and actually this may bring discussion of sort of the areas of research. There's the kind of research that is called basic research or fundamental research, mm-hmm. and then there is the research called applied mm-hmm. research. So applied sciences versus fundamental sciences. I am doing a fundamental science project, which means I am studying something for the purpose of simply understanding better the functioning of the cell, the okay. plant cell. It could be any other, you know, mouse cell, whatever, but I'm studying plants. So I am doing this project simply to understand at a deeper level the way that a plant cell works. Fundamental research eventually then is taken up by other researchers who do applied sciences, and the applied sciences focus on taking that knowledge, that fundamental knowledge, and devising applications that are of some human value. And so turning that deep understanding of plant biology, plant cell biology, and making a crop that is more resistant to drought, mm-hmm. or making it more resistant to heat, making it more productive, or telling breeders that are just breeding plants which genes to be breeding for, which particular combinations and crosses to make. So those are the two broad divisions of research. And as a fundamental scientist, once I complete and I have enough evidence to show a new way in which the cell behaves and does things and does the fundamental thing, I will then write what is called a scientific paper, a scientific mm-hmm. article. Mm-hmm. And I will present a lot of that data into figures, and I will write all the sections of a paper, a discussion, a results section, and I will present that to the scientific community so that there is a new and better understanding of a fundamental aspect of the cell. And the hope is that that feeds into what either applied scientists in academia or in government or in industry uses to design plants that can be more beneficial in some aspect to agriculture.
That's amazing. That just sounds like you as the fundamental researcher, you're providing the groundwork or the foundation for someone to be able to do something really practical with it that can be very beneficial. So I love that entire explanation.
If I can just give some examples, the entirety of the innovations in biotechnology that have surfaced over the decades are all the product of fundamental scientists discovering, refining our knowledge of living organisms. I am going to bring it up because it's probably what's most closest to people's memory. The discovery of mRNA's vaccine wasn't performed entirely, actually, in the majority of it, wasn't the product of the companies that eventually brought the vaccine to market. Mm-hmm. It's the product of decades and decades and decades of research in universities in the United States and across the world. Research that was published and then was available to the scientists, to the applied scientists at the companies that made those vaccines, that could then turn, make that final step and devise how to actually use that to produce, well, the vaccine or any other biotechnological product.
Amazing. Enrico, I could talk to you for hours about this because this just sounds fascinating, but we're almost out of time. So I want to make sure our listening audience has some information. Like, if they wanted to find out more about your research, how would they go about doing that?
You can find my profile on, if you search my name, Enrico Calvanese, plus UC Berkeley, you will see my photo pop up. I'm at the plant biology department, and you will be able to navigate to my laboratory's webpage where you'll get more information on what our laboratory does. If you then would like to specifically ask more questions, I'll be available to answer them. You can find my email there, or you can also connect with me through LinkedIn or any other platform.
And then if there's some young mind out there who is interested in plant biology, is there any book or documentary that you would recommend that they check out?
So if they want to be wowed by biology in general, and not just plant biology, but also plant biology, mm-hmm. I would recommend the same thing that I did that got me excited about it, which is watch the archives of documentaries that are already freely available everywhere online. I watched them when when YouTube at least wasn't full of these videos. Sure. I watched them on National Geographic, Discovery Channel, all the sorts. And I would say now they're even more available. So you can do that. And if you are a local to the Bay Area, then there is a class that actually is available to high schoolers called Genomes and Plant Health. It's not something that I am running, but it's something that I participate as an instructor, and it's available to high schoolers. So you should look up Genomes and Plant Health. It is run by one of the laboratories at the Plant Biology Department, and they will provide a free 2-day workshops on teachings of plant genetics and genomics.
Excellent, excellent. Well, and Enrico Calvanese, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I found it fascinating. And once again, I look forward to hearing more about your research.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. And just stay on the line. I have a couple of questions for you for afterwards. People.
1789. How does the bastard, orphan, immigrant, decorated war vet unite the colonies through more debt? Fight the other founding fathers till he has to forfeit. Have it all, lose it all. You ready for more yet? Treasury Secretary Washington's the president. Every American experiment sets a precedent. Not so fast. Someone came along to resist him. Pissed him off until we had a two-party system. You haven't met him yet. You haven't had the chance. Cause he's been kicking ass as the ambassador to France. But someone's gotta keep the American can't promise. You simply must meet Thomas. Thomas.
Thomas Jefferson's coming home.
Thomas Jefferson's coming home.
Thomas Jefferson's coming home.
Thomas Jefferson's coming home.
Thomas Jefferson's coming home. Lord, he's been off in Paris for so
revolution, there is no more status quo.
But the sun comes up and the world still spins.
I helped Lafayette draft a declaration. Then I said I gotta go.
I gotta be in Monticello. Now the work at home begins.
So what did I miss? What did I miss? Virginia, my home sweet home, I wanna give you a kiss. I've been in Paris meeting lots of different ladies. I guess I basically missed the late 80s. I traveled the wide, wide world and came back to this.
There's a letter on my desk from the president. Haven't even put my bag down yet. Sally, be a lamb, darling, won't you open it? It says the president's assembling a cabinet, and then I end up being the Secretary of State. Great, and I'm already standing approved. I just got home and now I'm headed up to New York.
Headed to New York, headed to New York.
Looking at the rolling fields, I can't believe that we are free. Ready to face whatever's awaiting me in NYC. But who's waiting for me when I step into place? My friend James Madison, red in the face. He grabs my arm and I respond.
Thomas, we are engaged in a battle for our nation's very soul. Can you get us out of the mess we're in? Hamilton's new financial plan is nothing less than government control. I've been fighting for the South alone. Where have you been?
France.
We have to win.
Well, what did I miss?
What did I miss?
What did I miss?
I'm so-
think of something to say. I'm already on my way to get to the bottom of this.
What did I miss?
Oh. Mr. Jefferson, welcome home.
Mr. Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton.
Mr. Jefferson, welcome home.
Mr. Jefferson, welcome home, sir. You've been off in Paris for so long.
So what did I miss?
Ah, you gotta love that. That's David Diggs, Leslie Odom Jr. It is What Did I Miss from Hamilton. David Diggs is a local, so we are, you know, we're just very proud of him. Also proud of a bunch of people. You know, this is community radio, so occasionally we like to have people from the community on. So we got some kids here in the studio who are learning about radio. We've got their mentor who's telling them, who's brought them here gracefully. So I'm actually going to let you all introduce yourself. So starting from left to right, go ahead.
I'm Stella Rosen.
You're Stella Rosen. Go on.
I'm a 12th grader at Jewish Community High School, The Bay, and I'm excited to be on here. Yeah.
Hooray. And madam?
Roni Ben-David, and I'm a teacher at Jewish Community High School.
Okay. Sir?
I'm Elijah Isaacson. I'm the only one here in 11th grade, but I'm also a student.
Okay. And you two gentlemen?
I'm Jacob Goldfeld. I'm a senior at Jewish Community High School of the Bay, and I'm from Daly City.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Eitan Joselowitz. I'm also a 12th grader from Jewish Community High School, and I'm from Oakland.
Okay, so we've got a good mix of people. So the first question I want to ask you all is, what got you interested in wanting to come to the radio station today?
So our teacher, about an hour ago, we were at assembly. Our teacher came up. She was like, it's Black History Month. This is the radio started by whatever. She told us the story of your radio for the people's radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess the other three people here, they knew about it before, but I heard and I was like, Miss Ben David, I want to come. So
okay.
I'm very excited to just learn more.
All right.
Not much about radio itself. We're not really in like a radio class or anything.
Oh, that's okay. Well, then how about we do this? We're going to turn the tables. First of all, talk a little bit, Ronnie, about what you do with these students.
I'm a big fan of KPOO. Just having lived in San Francisco, always mm-hmm. playing fresh music,
mm-hmm.
and that's really helpful when there's so much of the old stuff. A few years ago, we actually had JCHS students intern here. Jerome. And we've had guest speakers come to class, but of course, the student body keeps on changing. So mm-hmm. it was time to get reacquainted with KPOO, and just it holds down such an important role in the community and being listener supported. I just love that. I really appreciate that. And my goal is just to make sure our students get exposure to culture, to the roots, to the history of the Fillmore.
Mm-hmm.
That was my goal.
Okay, so I remember when that internship came through, there was a bunch of students and they actually put together a show, and we played that show a number of times because whenever we would have downtime, we would just go, well, let's put the show together, and they were on it. It was, I think it was like a 2-hour show, and they had little segments, and it was fantastic that, you know, they were on top of it, so I would expect nothing less from any of you were you to do it. So we're going to turn the tables. I normally do the questioning, but do you have any questions that you guys would like to ask me? State your name and what's your question?
My name is Eitan, and a question that I had is, like, how does the, do you feel like a sense of, like, obligation towards this, like, community, and how do you think that, like, plays out in how you decide to, like, run this studio?
Okay, well, I'll start with every single DJ who is here, we're all volunteer. Nobody gets paid. You do it because you love it. And I do feel a sense of responsibility to the community. For example, when the pandemic shut down everything, my feeling was that, like, there wasn't much I could do, but the one thing that I could do was tell people where they could get, like, food because, you know, they couldn't, you know, maybe their income was interrupted, or where they could get free vaccines, what was going on. That was me, like, trying to return to the community. And also, by, you know, I would have people in here. It's a community station. We're only able to do what we do because of you guys and all the people who listen. So, yeah, I do feel a sense of responsibility. Everyone does, and it does affect how they interact with the people who email us, how they interact with the people that they have on the show. It sort of colors everything. So thanks. Excellent question. Anyone else?
My name's Jacob Goldfeld.
Mm-hmm.
I was just curious, what got you into DJing in the first place? Because I'm also trying to become a DJ, and I'm just curious, yeah, well, like, what inspired you to become a DJ?
Actually, it was completely random. I had been working at a company that shut down, and I didn't have anything to do, and a friend of mine said, oh, you should go to KPOO, and I was like, what's that? And he told me, and I listened to it, and the very first program that I heard was this woman, Peppermint Patty, who does this show, and there was a news article, and this is a very graphic story. There's a news article about a guy who had injected cocaine, and parts of his body started falling off because he didn't go to the doctor in time, so he lost pretty much all of his all 11 digits, we'll just say it that way. And so then she played Patsy Cline's I Fall to Pieces, and I thought, that's a special kind of wrong. I need to see what's going on here. And I showed up, and the station manager at the time, Joe Rudolph, put me on the air the same day that I came in because they were short a DJ, and I walked in, and the first thing they were like, oh, they'll show me how to go find out how to queue up records, and the DJ showed me. Oh, go practice. Okay, well, go on the air. So, I thought I was coming in for an interview, and I was just thrown on the air, and I never looked back.
But like, you had prior experience?
No, doing it? Not at all. None whatsoever. Zip, wow. Zilch, nada. Wow. No, it was just, that's the beauty of community. The difference between the corporate sector and the nonprofit or community sector is it's just your willingness to do something and your willingness to be reliable that will get you places versus, because nobody knows anything that they're doing. It's just someone takes a chance on you. Mm-hmm. And then you either sink or swim based on you. Mm-hmm. So if you are focused and driven, you'll make a mark. And if you are just kind of flaky, see you in 2 weeks or never again. Mm-hmm. Who else? Any other questions?
Like, as a DJ, what are some, like, okay, this is a very broad question, but, like, what are your top three albums you've been, like, listening to, like, nonstop lately? I know that's, like, a fun question, yeah.
Okay, so I go through periods where I get just stuck on something. So, like, when Hamilton came out, I listened to it, like, religiously for it, every day. Hadestown, same thing.
I love that show.
I was trapped in Hadestown.
Yes.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, bought the whole thing. Just mm-hmm. listened to it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So that... But I think that is part and parcel of why I'm a DJ, is because I can go down these rabbit holes with different types of music. For example, today I just heard a song that I had thought was an original song from the Crybaby soundtrack, but it turned out no, it was the original person who did it. And I'm all in now, and I will be. It's called Please, Mr. Jailer, and I'm all in, and I'm going to be listening to that for like weeks now, because I was like, this is the original. I can't believe this.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not so much a favorite, just, I listen to Bug Music a lot.
Oh.
Bug Music's the name of the CD. It's one of those CDs you can just sort of throw on and everybody goes, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
It's the name of Don Byron. So, go ahead.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I'll say that I'm Elijah, just a reminder.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that as soon as I heard the announcement, I was thinking about Black History Month and Black culture, and how this, me as an individual, I've gone to Jewish private schools my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in Berkeley. I'm traveling really far. I don't have much of a base of, I don't have really much of a social base in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how I have no Black friends, and I feel a sense of guilt about that, because amidst all just the politics around being a Jew,
mm-hmm.
we're talking a lot about bridging the gap, mm-hmm. and we just had a Palestinian activist come to our school, mm-hmm. and speak, and so I feel very good about all that. But I'm wondering, just in the spirit of becoming a worldly person,
mm-hmm.
How does your radio show kind of bridge the social gap and get people to talk to people that they wouldn't otherwise, or just become a more all-around, aware, friendly, loving person towards anybody they meet?
Well, I can go back to the origins of the station, when I believe that there were so many people who were very different, but they were all of the same mind, that we don't have to agree, but it's important that we all get a voice. I know that there was like a police officer who was part of the board. There were people from all walks of life, and it's really that you all have to come together over a common belief that speech is important,
mm.
and even the people you don't agree with have a right to speak it, as long as it's respectful. And I was just thinking about this earlier today, that basically everyone's got a target on their back right now, whether you're Jewish, Palestinian, Muslim, Black, everybody's got a target on their back. And those targets are put there by the people who want to control everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who have all of the power, and they will pit everyone against each other. So the way to get around that is to talk to one another and instead of throwing out invectives and insults, you speak facts. You say, this is what happened and this is how it affected me. And you listen when people say, this is what happened and this is how it affected me. And then you can understand where they're coming from. You may not necessarily agree with the conclusion that they